Hi, this is Climate Challenge, a podcast by the International PhD College of the University of Bologna on the social environmental crisis.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our new podcast episode, Climate Change Policies and Their Implementation. I am Kaushika Srikant, a second-year PhD in astrophysics at the University of Bologna. I'm your host in this episode. In our previous episodes, we have extensively discussed the various consequences of climate change. In this episode, we shift our focus to climate change policies, how they should be structured, their feasibility and effectiveness, and also the extent to which they have been actually implemented in reality. We will also explore the future of these policies and examine the influence of current global events such as war, advancements in AI, etc. And to discuss about all of this, we have the perfect guest for today's discussion. Joining us is Erik Solheim, a distinguished Norwegian diplomat, former politician, and a global environmental leader. He served as a Norway's Minister of International Development and Minister of Environment from 2005 to 2012. And later he was the head of Development Assistance Committee of OECD in 2013. From 2016 to 2018, he was the Undersecretary General of United Nations and Executive Director of the United Nations Environment Programme. Beyond his political and also diplomatic roles, Erik Solheim has been actively involved in peacekeeping efforts during civil wars in Asia. He continues to serve as a climate change advisor to several countries, including Tamil Nadu, India, where he is a key member of the state's Climate Council. Additionally, he contributes to numerous global advisory committees focused on sustainability and legacy initiatives. Thank you for joining us today, Erik. We are in much pleasure and happy to welcome you on our show. Welcome aboard.
I'm so happy to be on your show, and I still recall visiting Bologna. It's a wonderful city, one of the nicest cities in Europe.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm in France at the moment, so all is well. But I'm going to China next week, and I was in India last week, so it's a lot of travel.
Wow. I'm going to start with a very big question. How important do you think is peace for the world? And I just don't mean peace for the countries that are in war zone. I'm talking about peace in a broader sense, how it affects society, nature, and even the planet itself.
I believe that of all questions, peace is the most important of all. For two reasons. Of course, wars bring an enormous destruction. I mean, just this week, 150 children died in Gaza because of Israeli bombing. Lots of people are dying in Ukraine, in Myanmar, in Sudan, and in other wars. And many, many, many more people are getting their lives destroyed. They become handicapped, or they become refugees, or whatever. So wars are enormously destructive. Added, they also distract, because political leaders tend to focus on how to bring peace, how to solve wars, and then they don't have any capacity for the long-term issues like climate change or environment destruction or how to rig our economies and not to bring everyone out of poverty. So wars are directly destructive and indirectly because they distract from the long-term issues.
Exactly. Well said. And the reason I'm asking you this because you played a huge role in trying to end the Sri Lankan civil war. For 8 years, you were working to bring a peace on the table. And so you have seen the first-hand value of peace. And later when Ranil Wickremesinghe became the president, you became the special advisor for climate change for Sri Lanka. Which shows that, according to my understanding, your peace efforts weren't just political. They had a deeper intention. So do you believe peace and climate change are like directly connected?
They are very much connected. Of course, climate effects may unfortunately lead to more vulnerability and more conflicts. If a huge number of people are made refugees because of climate, well, they will move to another place. They may not be welcome there. And you may have conflict, just as one example of the relationship between climate and conflict. It's not like climate change directly immediately brings conflict, but the tendency will be more conflicts if we don't solve the climate issues. So there is a very strong relationship between the two that was also very much realized by a person you mentioned, Ranil Wickremesinghe. He was my partner back in the days in the peace process in Sri Lanka. Later he was prime minister and president. and is very, very dedicated to fight against climate change. But we need to bring peace. And the main issue, if you want to bring peace, is to make people understand the value of compromise. And sometimes people speak negatively about compromise, but give it a second thought. I mean, think of your family. If, say, your father wanted to decide everything in the family, everything, what you will eat for dinner, what entertainment you will have, where you will go for a holiday, where you will live, best, where you will study, everything. Well, it's a recipe for disaster. Even the smallest of unit, a family need a compromise between the husband and the wife and the children simply to work and survive. Exactly the same is the case inside nations and between nations. And when people tell you that they don't want to compromise, tell them maybe that's exactly what you should do. We cannot solve the war in Ukraine without a compromise. There need to be a settlement where there is give and take on both sides. Some of these may be painful. Say Ukraine may have to give away some of the land which was rightly theirs, but it may happen as a part of a conflict. And in the case of the Palestinians and the Israelis, we need two states, one state for the Jews, another for the Palestinians. And again, it will not be easy to be a compromise, but that's the only way to peace. If you say, I will get everything my way, it's a recipe for conflict.
Okay. So the takeaway should be we should have diplomacy, then compromise, peace, so that less effects on climate change.
Unfortunately, it's very easy, it's very, very easy to start wars and very difficult to stop them. Nearly always, the start of war, believe it, will be very short, very successful, and I will win.
Yeah.
And in nearly all cases, it is much, much longer, much more bloody than those starting the war believe, and it's much more difficult to end the war. So we need to stop wars from happening and end them when they're already there.
True. And how much do you think a country at war can suffer from climate change? Because when you took as a role of special climate change advisor for Sri Lanka, what were your challenges? You mentioned there were a lot of refugees and it also creates a loop of climate change problems around the world, not just in Sri Lanka. So especially country for a post-civil war. And why am I asking is this? Because with your experience, we wanted to extrapolate the results for the major wars that are happening today in the world.
When I advised the government of Sri Lanka, I told them, look, please look at climate change not as a problem, but as an opportunity. And for the first time in human history, the price of solar and renewables is much lower than coal. We switch from fossil fuels and coal to solar energy. Not only is it much better for the environment, everyone knows, not much better for the health, also everyone knows, but it's also much better for the wallet. You save money by making that switch. So the old idea that there is an enormous cost going green, yes, it was the case 10, 15 years ago, but no longer. And my main message to Sri Lanka was, look at opportunities. This tropical island the sun is shining 365 days a year in Sri Lanka. You can provide solar energy. You have a long coast and it's very shallow. Huge opportunity for offshore wind energy. And there are waterfalls in Sri Lanka which can produce hydropower. So look for these opportunities in going green. Add it, because Sri Lanka has wonderful nature, wildlife, which will attract tourists. And it can also use its wetlands and its mangroves as an opportunity to get carbon credits from the global market. Those nations who focus on the opportunities are much more successful than those who focus on the problems.
That's an amazing quote said by you. I think the world should take it today. Climate change is an opportunity and not to see it as a problem. And the next question I have for you is, every year something new is trending, but trends are getting shorter and shorter. With Instagram and TikTok, like literally anything could go viral tonight and tomorrow they might be vanished. I personally feel like between the year 2015 to 2019, climate change was at its peak. It was like a massive climate awareness boom in Europe. But now it feels like the trend has faded. The world has bigger problems to focus on and people just don't seem that invested. Firstly, do you agree with this statement? And has climate change really lost its momentum?
You're of course right that there is less public attention to climate change in Europe now than it was 10 years ago or 5 years ago. And there's less of this particularly student-led or youth-led climate move. However, the opportunities to fix the problem is much higher because the main driver of the change now is the price. I mean, when we had climate conferences 10 years ago, not at one point anyone told me, look, Eric, in 10 years, the price of solar energy will fall by 90%. But that's what's driving change now. It's so much cheaper. So if you switch from coal to solar, you save money. And that's why it's happening. And that's much more important than all these political movements. And Europe also needs to be a little less arrogant. We tend to believe in Europe that we are the world leaders. On climate, we are not. The two world leaders on climate is by far China, without any discussion, and secondly, India. Look, China last year added 280 gigawatt of solar energy to the grid. How much is that? Well, it's double as much as the second nation, United States of America, had constructed in the entire existence of America before that. So 1 year add-on in China is more than the entire history of the United States. And of course, it's also much, much more than we do in Europe. But switch to India. Prime Minister Modi just launched a scheme for 10 million rooftops in India with solar. Well, one rooftop is not that much, but 10 million, that's enormous. And the Indian state of Gujarat, which may be the lead state in India, are now embarking upon a solar and wind farm, is 30 gigawatt. How much is that? Well, it's, for instance, 15 times more than the Norwegian oil company Equinor has claimed they will bring in 2030. They claim this is a renewable effort measure from Equinor. Well, this just one plant in India is 15 times more. So these are gigantic. And it's no longer Europe, it's leads. It's number one, China, and number two, India. Sorry to say.
Yes, but to add on and also to my next question, the reason why Europe is not leading is because politically, Europe is different today. And in the last 10 years, Europe has evolved a lot. Europe has many problems on its table right now, like inflation, recession, immigration. So people also want a leader who focus on that. Doesn't it alarm you? How to bring back Europe on track with climate change?
I frankly don't believe that is the main reason why Europe is not leading on climate. The European Commission, von der Leyen, which is the head of the European Commission, just launched the European targets for 2030, and they are good. They want to make 100 gigawatt more of renewables every year. So it's not that the European leaders have, so to say, abolished the climate agenda, even if you're right, they're focused a lot on other issues. That's not the main problem in Europe. The main problem in Europe is slowness in bureaucracy, lack of dedicated political leadership to make things happen. Number one issue stopping renewables in Europe is permits. I mean, you can set up a big solar farm or windmills or hydropower without government permit, of course, because you need to make sure that it's done in accordance with laws, with the environment regulations, with the local people. So that's all good. But it's so slow, so bureaucratic, and takes so long. China and India has a much stronger and more powerful leadership to make sure it happens. And that's our problem. We need to get this better. Otherwise, we will be lagging far behind our Asian brothers and sisters.
But as a student in Europe, I think we are all very optimistic that Europe will catch up soon, because there is also a student movement happening here and there where students are raising their voice against climate change. Let's hope for it. And next is a simple question. You could answer yes or no, but it would be a deep answer, I think. Do you think climate change is a tough pill to sell?
I believe we have sold it in the wrong way, and that environmentalists should put up a big mirror and ask ourselves, did we do this in the right way? So many of the environmentalists have believed that you need to scare people into action, don't really work. Some in the UN, they believe to bore people into action is so incredibly boring. you're listening to any number of PowerPoint presentations. They're incredibly boring, full of acronyms which no one understands, full of text which no one can read, and it bores people into to death. You need to make climate action, to put it that way, sexy, joyful, interesting. And no, I believe that...
It's not climate change that is tough. It's the people who present about climate change are making it scary and boring.
Many people who speak about climate change, yes, make it very, very boring, make it very intellectual. So it is all basically only targeted to intellectual. It must be a message. I mean, for any number of farmer in France, industrial worker in Spain, housewife in Italy, let it be a message for everyone. Retired people in the United Kingdom, just to speak about Europe. It must be a message for everyone, not just for some young and trendy intellectuals. That then is failing. When it's boring, it's failing. And when you try to scare people rather than inspire people, you fail. You need to tell people, this is the way forward. This is how we'll solve this problem. People want action, not just scaremongering.
That is another important quote from you today. Climate change is for everybody. So since you have been involved with United Nations Environment Program, and you were also Under Secretary General in United Nations, let's dive into climate change policies. We have got the Paris Agreement, one of the biggest cooperative agreements in history. 150 plus countries signed it. If it was strictly followed, it could literally shake up the world in climate change. But do you think it is actually effective? If not, what do you think could be done to make it work?
The most important driver of climate action now is not the diplomacy of like Paris Agreement or the annual conference of the parties discussing climate, it's the economy. It's the fact that it's much cheaper to produce solar and wind energy or hydropower. So that's where we see the switch. Or look, everyone understands that the future will be electric cars. Just this week, BYD, which is the lead electric car company in the world, now introduced a new charging system in China. It will take less or the same amount of time to charge your car 400 kilometers. Well, then you can go from Rome to Milan in just one charge. You charge that in exactly the same time as you in the past used when you were at the filling station getting gasoline, about 5 minutes. And the batteries are, of course, now increasing. There will be 1,000 kilometers very soon. And so the technology and the electric car is much more autonomous. It's much more comfortable. In a cold climate like back home in Norway, it's much easier to heat in winter. So no one who ever bought an electric car wanted to go back. No one. Everyone wants to be with this. Everyone understands that. So the future will be electric. We just need to speed it up and overcome some conservative action by some political leaders. I mean, let me just give one inspiring example. The other day I was running in the morning in Beijing. It was along a very, very heavily trafficked motor road. And then I took off my iPods to listen. There was no noise. Why? All buses were electric. All taxis were electric. More than half of all new cars are electric. Even most trucks were electric. And then there is no noise. And who wants to go back to the old? No one wants that. So this change will happen. But we need political leaders and business leaders to speed up what will ultimately happen.
Okay. So since you mentioned about BYD, I would also like to add on that BYD recently signed an agreement with Saudi. They will have the world's largest grid-scale energy storage project, which is a very good step that Saudi Arabia is going forward in renewable energy. My question over here is, do you think any other country is already ready to make such big deals in renewable energy? And if developed countries and developing countries needs a different roadmap of how they should become sustainable. I mean, not everybody is on the same playing field, right? Some still needs basic building infrastructure, while others are already way ahead where they can be sustainable. So how do you see this? Like, how we make sustainability for all nations common?
Look, there is no doubt that the agreement you spoke about where BYD, the Chinese company, is providing battery in Saudi Arabia is a big deal. But it's not the only deal. Indian state of Gujarat very recently made the lowest price for the combination of solar energy and battery storage at any part in the world. Fantastic low price. And it showcased how we can make solar work because, of course, there is not some 365. Well, in Gujarat, there is sun every day, but not, of course, not at night. So you need a battery. And if it can happen in a Chinese-Saudi partnership, but it also can happen in Gujarat, well, it can happen everywhere. I basically believe that the way forward is the same for developed and developing nations. But there may be one specific issue for developing nations, and that is sometimes there is a startup price. It's an upfront price which is higher. Look, I mean, if you are an owner of an electric car, you will always save money in the 10 to 15 years of lifespan of that car. It's much cheaper than the gasoline car. But it may be an upfront higher cost. And for poor people or middle-class people, it may be difficult to take that upfront cost, and they need a bank or someone to make sure that you spread the cost. I was just in the Indian state of UP or Uttar Pradesh. That's one of the poorest parts of India, much poorer than your home state of Tamil Nadu. And people there doing small business. And they told me, now we save a lot of money. In the past, we paid $500 a month or 500 euros a month for diesel. Now we pay 200 for solar. And after four years, we will even be the owners of the solar. So there's no cost at all. But the upfront cost of moving to solar is there. And then you need a company and banks who can take that cost and spread it over 4 years. And then these small-scale business persons, and there are hundreds of thousands of them in a place like India, millions of them, they can all make the switch, but they will need this bank arrangement. One small-scale business cannot approach the big banks because the big banks don't have time for them. But if you bundle all this together, you can get a scheme where hundreds of thousands of small businesses can move, go solar and save money.
Yes, that is an amazing idea to developing countries, like how they can move forward. Moving on to the next question. So you told we do not want a different roadmap for developing and the developed countries. Probably we should focus on how the investments are made. Like, for example, bank should be ready to give loans or to give it in a less interest to the public. So that's a very good point. And we also do have summits that happens every year to talk about all of this. So from COP21 that happened in Paris, where we signed the Paris Agreement, to COP29 in Baku, we have come a long way talking about all the policies that needs to be tailored for all the nations. Do you have any key takeaways from COP29 that our audience should know? Something that actually stood out?
Yes, there was one very positive development in the Baku climate talks, and that was the carbon market. It was an agreement as to how the carbon market can be mobilized to get more finance for, say, forest restoration, mangrove, upgrading, green agriculture, and renewables in developing countries. So that's a huge step forward, and that money is much more likely to flow than the money which is going through the international institutions because, sorry to say, they are so bureaucratic, so slow, that very little is happening, even if there are good intentions. So I think that was a major breakthrough in Baku.
Okay. Now, I'm going to link you with the previous question that I asked earlier about the funding. Because in COP29, there was also this issue of funding. 1.3 trillion was asked, and finally they settled down for 300 billion. And as you told, many things that stood out. We do need funding for all of this to at least inculcate in the developing countries. So do you think 300 billion is enough? Or what is the actual number we are looking at here to make a difference in the world in climate change?
I basically think that this discussion at the climate talks will bring us nowhere. then the demand from the developing world is absolutely fair. Absolutely, 100%. I mean, look, US emissions per capita up to today is 25 times Indian emissions per capita. And the difference to Africa is even bigger. So, of course, the US should pay. But we know that Donald Trump won't pay $1. And even if Europe will pay something, still it will be pity money. And this money will also tend to be very, very bureaucratic, very slow, and very little will happen. The money which will drive the change is very simple. You need to get the policies right, and then the forces of the market will go to where there are good investment opportunities. And again, solar panels is no longer a cost. Windmill is no longer a cost. It's cheaper to develop solar or wind energy than there is to go into coal and oil and gas. It's not like people didn't invest in coal in the past. They invested in because it was the only opportunity to bring prosperity. But now we can bring prosperity by going green. That's, of course, why the two most impactful leaders of not the developed, but the developing world, which is President Xi Jinping of China and Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India, both of them are fully focused not on getting money from somewhere else, but how to develop their own green industries to provide prosperity and growth. 2 weeks ago, I was in the Indian city of Bhopal, in the state of Madhya Pradesh. I listened to Prime Minister Modi for 1 hour, and Modi had just one message, and that was how to develop that state with 80 million people, so it's like Germany, so it matters, how to develop it by going green. How to bring every person in the state out of poverty by doing it by solar panels, by windmills, by pump storage, and by upgrading the green opportunities of the state. I mean, for instance, this state is declared as the tiger state of India. Yes, they love tigers, but they also love tourists. When tourists come, there are tigers. So looking for these green opportunities, that's what Modi is doing. And that's why India is successful, while some of the developing countries are not successful because they spend all the time demanding money, which I'm sorry to say, it won't come, even if it's very fair.
True. And talking about policies that has been implemented in India and China, there is also one more important policy that stands out of this decade is by UK. They have their net zero policy. That is, by 2050, they wanted to bring the emission to 0% carbon emission, which means by 2030, they have to reduce it by 45%. Is it even? They do have their own policies that were tailor-made to reach net zero. And do you think it is actually possible? And if it is possible, can other countries inspire from that?
Yeah, I think UK has done quite a lot right. They have invested a lot in offshore wind, which is a huge source of energy. Paradoxically, while the UK was the nation which invented the Industrial Revolution, and one reason why they did it was that they had an abundance of coal. It was also a favorable political system, but the amount of coal and the waterways to bring the coal around was probably the main reason why the Industrial Revolution happened in the UK. And the UK then became probably the first major developed country which abandoned coal 100%. So that's a great triumph for the UK and a great inspiration for the world. And we should all learn from it. And of course, other nations look to the UK for inspiration, but of course, there are other sources of inspiration in Europe also. But at the moment, China and India is moving faster than we are. But the UK is also a good example, absolutely.
So next, I wanted to ask you, there are so many skeptical things around this topic, and I think, including me and the audience, want a clear clarity on this. Are carbon bonds really useful? And what do you think about them?
Yes, I believe it's absolutely useful. It's a way of mobilizing private finance for green investment in all the sectors which I've already mentioned. I mean, look, there will always be people who are cheating. In politics, there are a lot of people lying. I mean, the most powerful person in the world is lying every day. It's not a day where there's not a lie from Donald Trump on global media. Also, business leaders will try to cheat. But overall, even if there is some cheating, this is a massive positive force. And of course, it's then the job of media and job of civil society groups and others to discover if someone is floating a carbon bond and a green bond, which is kind of greenwashing, not true. Well, in the long run, it will not be successful because it will always be detected by all the forces out there. You can fool people in the short run, but in the long run, you cannot fool all your employees, all your customers, and everyone else. It won't work. So yes, indeed, bonds are a good idea.
That is a very positive answer from you. If any industrialist is listening to our podcast, listen to it, people. Carbon bonds are very good. So when you were the head of OECD's DAC program, you also pointed out the importance of private investment in climate change. Let's say if I'm an investor and if I have a lot of money, I will invest in a startup that tells that in 5 years, I have my return of investments. But how you will motivate an investor to invest in a climate change problem? His point of view will be, what will be my return of investment, right? So how to touch that audience?
The one answer to that is that governments need to regulate market so that people can invest safely in this area. Just to take it to a little higher level, I mean, the year I was born, Madagascar and South Korea was at the same level. Today, people in Madagascar are poorer than the grandparents were back in the 1950s. Average person in South Korea is 390 times richer. I mean, everyone, there's no poverty any longer in South Korea. At the time, it was horrible poverty there. Why? And that's the global recipe, because South Korea got development-oriented leaders who did drive the change. I mean, some of them were right-wing dictators, but they were non-corrupt and driving change in South Korea. Secondly, they believed in the forces of the market, exactly what you say, business must drive the change. And through that, they have developed Hyundai, Samsung. I mean, all over Europe, you can find Samsung phones and electric equipment. And that's an enormous achievement of a relatively small nation in Asia. And they believe in education. These three, political leadership, the forces of the market, and education, that's what have been driving change. And that's why, well, Japan, Korea, Singapore, Vietnam, China, now India are so successful. And some other nations are not so successful. And that's also the recipe for climate action.
Okay, wow. That's nice. Next question is just a personal curiosity that I have. Can different taxation solve at least half of the climate change problems? This is because, like, Nordic countries are known for its climate change policies and it has stood out around the world and it has inspired a lot of countries. And the recent move by Denmark to have taxes even for methane produced in cattle farming, it is a very bold move. So can different taxation at least solve half of the climate change problems in a country?
Yes, I basically think so. I mean, you need to tax what you don't want and to relieve taxes on what you do want. Let me give you one example from my hometown in Norwegian government. We wanted Norwegians to embrace electric cars. But at the time, the electric cars were much more expensive than the gasoline cars. Then they said, well, let's make an introductory offer. Everyone driving an electric car will get priority access to parking spots. They will be able to drive into town in the bus lanes, so they have some favorable conditions. And added, we will change the tax system so that electric cars become cheaper and the gasoline cars become relatively more expensive. And since all cars are taxed in Norway, it's not a subsidy, but it's a change in the tax burden from electric cars to gasoline cars. And it made the trick. Now 95% of all new cars sold in Norway are electric. Everyone wants them. And of course, one reason was that they became relatively cheaper compared to the gasoline cars. I mean, people who are even absolutely against the environment, they may hate the environmentalists, they may vote for parties who are dead against the green parties, but still they want electric cars because they are more high-tech, more comfortable, better, and cheaper.
Yes, that's an amazing strategical move, I would say. Now, since you talked about policies that were implemented in Norway, I wanted to specifically know if there were any policies that you brought up during your tenure as a Minister of Environment and Climate Change.
Yeah, that maybe the thing I'm most proud of was that I introduced a system to support nations to protect the rainforests. And the rainforests are maybe the most amazing ecosystem in the world. And at the time, Norway decided we will support nations in protecting the rainforest. And that was the start of what later became UN RED, which became a UN program. And Norway, we started with Brazil and with Indonesia and with Guyana, a small nation in Latin America, because they set the policies. They decided to how to protect the forest, but we supported by a substantial amount of money. And look, last year, Indonesia brought deforestation down to zero. That's the second largest rainforest nation in the world. It's an enormous achievement for Indonesia and for the world. And to be able to help that process, even in a small way, I'm very proud of it. But of course, the honor goes to the government of Indonesia under the then President Jokowi and the big business of Indonesia, who understood that, look, we can have all our profits, create all the jobs without destroying the forest, because those policies are available. But giving a small push and a small support to this, that's the one thing I'm most proud of from my time in government.
Okay, so you mentioned Indonesia brought deforestation to zero last year. Now, the main question I have, this I have also asked it earlier in this episode. Indonesia is a small country, so it was easy for Indonesia to bring it down. I don't mean easy that it happened in an overnight, but the policies were okay for Indonesia and they were able to bring it down to zero. Can I apply the same in Brazil? Is that even possible? Or like any other big country?
Look, Indonesia is only small compared to China and India. Indonesia is the fourth largest country in the world when it comes to population and also expected to be the fourth largest economy in the world by 2050. So that 280 million people in Indonesia is not small. The rainforest in Brazil is a little bigger because Brazil is the largest rainforest nation. But Indonesia rainforest is also enormous. And basically, I believe the policies which will save the forest are the same. The drivers of deforestation are a little different. And cattle is maybe the main driver of deforestation in Brazil, while palm oil probably is the main driver in Indonesia. So not exactly the same. But largely, the policies and set strict regulations from the government and provide livelihood in the forest for the people living there. That's the most important. I mean, that 20 million people living in Brazilian Amazon, that's as many as all people living in the Nordic countries of Europe combined. Well, they need a livelihood there. And what we did from the Norwegian side was helping with setting up businesses which can work, give people jobs while in the forest, helping with cricket in Guyana, where they love cricket, or soccer in Brazil, where they love soccer. Setting up small data centers where people living in the forest can connect to the internet. All these things which make life in the forest easy and happy, but without destroying the forest.
Okay. So since you talked about Guyana, Guyana has the largest forest reserves and they're also in climate change crisis. Would you like to elaborate it to our audience about the Guyana forest coverage and what is really happening over there in the recent days?
Absolutely. Guyana probably has the lowest rate of deforestation of any nation in the world. It's maybe 1% of the forest in Guyana which is destroyed, which is very, very, very low. And that in the back in the days, because there were very few people except from indigenous groups living in the forest. So, but now, it's because the government of Guyana, they received money first from Norway. Now they have received also money from the global carbon market and from some global companies to protect the forest. And what they do is exactly what I say, making sure that people can have a livelihood in the forest, making sure they can have entertainment and fun in the forest, making sure that they can connect to the world from the forest, making a good life in the forest, but without destroying it. And we started partnering with Guyana exactly for this reason, while there had been substantial deforestation in Indonesia, Brazil, Colombia, basically any other rainforest nation. There had been none in Guyana. And then President of Ghana, Barat Ogdeo, he told me, this is unfair. You will only pay money to those nations who have destroyed some forests. We haven't. Should we also get some? And then we decided to work with Ghana, and it has been amazingly successful. I may add that Ghana is also the most Indian nation in the Western Hemisphere. Half of the population there are of Indian origin. And I mean, even the name of this president, Bharat Ogdeo, of course, Bharat is India. So he's a Hindu. So it shows the close relationship to India, even if these are people who came from India 150 years ago. So it's not recent, but it shows this kind of cross-cultural, very interesting aspects of the world.
That's amazing. And what you think the upcoming COP summits should really focus on? Since now we have discussed about different parts of the world, different countries, what are their actual needs? So what should be the upcoming COP summits really focus on? Because every year they come with a theme. This year it was about how they're going to give the funding for the developing countries. The last year it was about renewable energy and fossil fuels. What should be the theme for the upcoming COP summits?
I think it's very clear what will be the theme, because Brazil, President Lula, has decided to host this in Belém. Belém is the second biggest city in Brazilian Amazon, and a city really, really at the Amazon River in the midst of the forest. So for sure, the focus would be on the protection of Amazon, but by extension, the protection of nature, protection of forest everywhere in the world, and the links between nature and climate. For instance, how we can, by protecting forests, by protecting mangroves, by protecting green areas in the world, we can also help alleviate the climate crisis. Protecting mangroves, for instance, I mean, you told me you are from the state of Tamil Nadu in India. Tamil Nadu has a very long coast. There are lots of mangroves along that coast. I have been there. And protecting and expanding these mangroves, it takes efforts. The government of Tamil Nadu is very eager to do it, and there are also civil society groups and others who want to do it. But helping them, providing also finance for that through the carbon market, that's yet another way to help to fight climate change. So protecting the forest in Brazil, well, it's restoring mangroves in Tamil Nadu, is at the end of the day part of the same global process.
So do you think next year when Brazil hosts the COP summit, it will take influence or inspiration from Indonesia to bring the deforestation to zero? Will they theme it around it? Is there any possibility?
I'm sure Brazil will continue to reduce deforestation. I'm not sure they want to give all the credit to Indonesia, because they want credit for themselves. But let me point to one policy in Brazil, which I think is very, very good. And that's the relationship between the central government and the indigenous groups. I mean, the Indians, as we normally in the past we used to talk about them, but the indigenous groups in the Amazon. I mean, these groups they're living in the forest. They know everything is happening in the forest. They can do a lot to protect the forest, but only if they're empowered by the state. Because the forces of the state, the police and the military, are, of course, much, much stronger than these groups. So during the previous president, Mr. Bolsonaro, the forces of the state were often used to go against the indigenous people. But when these forests, I mean, when the police, forest department, military, and the indigenous group works hand in hand, it becomes very, very powerful, because the forces of the state can arrest people who do harm, and the indigenous groups would know where these people are, what they're doing, and they can ring the alarm bell at an early stage. So this combination of indigenous with the state is very, very powerful and will help reduce deforestation in the Amazon.
Okay, that is very informative. And since you mentioned Tamil Nadu twice in the podcast, I would also add a question about Tamil Nadu. You are recently been appointed as a member of Climate Council under Chief Minister M.K. Stalin in Tamil Nadu, India. So for our audience, Tamil Nadu is a state in India, and it is also the place from where I come from. Are there any upcoming policies in the region, or has anything already been implemented that the world can take a note or use it as an example?
Most developed state in India, much, much richer than particularly the northern states. And there are lots to be learned from Tamil Nadu, but let me point to two areas. One is protection of nature. Tamil Nadu has wonderful forests, mangroves, national parks, there are tigers, elephants, many animals there. And the government of Mr. Stalin has declared a number of new reserves, new park areas. That's, of course, great for tourism in the state, but also very, very good for the protection of animals. And India tend to have a bit different and more positive attitude to animals than we have in Europe. If an elephant or a tiger is attacking humans, which happens, unfortunately, of course, well, India will replace it into a new habitat, while in Europe, if an animal is aggressive, it will normally always be taken off, out the zoo, meaning being killed. So that's one, the nature. The other area is wind power. Tamil Nadu has very good wind resources. It has a lot of windmills at land, and it has very shallow waters between Tamil Nadu and Sri Lanka. I mean, 7,000-8,000 years, there was a land bridge there, which has disappeared by water, but the land is very shallow. So there is enormous opportunities both for offshore wind and for repowering the windmills which are there. They tend to be many and small. They can be replaced by much fewer and much bigger and more efficient windmills. I mean, the biggest windmills in the day, the blade is circumventing 7 soccer fields in one turn. So these are enormous installations, but producing a lot more energy. So if you want me to point to two things, the protection of nature in Tamil Nadu and wind power as two great opportunities. But of course, solar power in Tamil Nadu is also a fantastic opportunity. There's it's basically 30 degrees in Tamil Nadu every day, 365 days a year.
So that's a great information our audience can take from what people are doing down south. Now let's go to the last part of the podcast. So we know that policies are for diplomats and people who are involved in government. What do you think an individual person should do, or how much of the responsibility actually falls on an individual in a climate change problem?
One individual alone cannot do much. But when an individual acts with others, it becomes an irresistible force. The great Indian leader Mahatma Gandhi once said that you need to be the change you want to see in this world. And if a young person demands solar panels on the university roofs or in the village of his home, stop drinking from plastic and use normal cups like this, start using his or her internet presence to present good stories about the environment, start planting trees in the village or in the park nearby. All these are small acts, but when they sum up in thousands, tens of thousands, millions are doing it, it becomes an enormous force. So my suggestion is very simple. I mean, be active, be engaged, and be certain that many, many others will follow you. Then it will have impact. Just I or just you are doing something, it's not impactful, but when it's part of an enormous force. That's how the world has been changed in the past. Back in the days, slavery was normal everywhere until some people asked, is this really normal? And started picking up the fight, and then I mean, today there's not one slave in the world. There are some people living in very horrible conditions. But nowhere in the world you can go to the police and say, you are my slave and I'm owning you. Because Trump picked up the fight. And there's so many other examples. I mean, India was in the UK until Gandhi and others started a huge movement to get it out of the UK. And now it's, for the last, soon to be 80 years, been an independent, strong nation.
Very well said. So I could take it as the responsibility is equal for the diplomats and also for the individual. So if many individuals start together, they can become a group and they can create a revolution. Am I right?
Yes. Yes, you're absolutely right. That's how revolutions happen.
Okay. All right. This is the last question of our podcast. And also, I think this is an important question. Let's talk about AI. Because it is blooming around the world, too many investments are pouring in, and every day we get new AI models. I'm not denying how important AI has become in our lives, but we have drill baby drill on one side of the table, and we have plug baby plug on the other side of the table, which is the quote that was the main theme of the AI 2025 summit by the President of France, Emmanuel Macron. So, do you have ever thought that going to AI or like investing so much on AI, we will be back to square one in climate change, because it needs a lot of power. And also we need a lot of data storage centers, which also again requires power. So what is your take on AI?
It's of course absolutely true that data centers require a lot of power. However, it may be less than people thought. If you look to the DeepSeek model, which just came out of China, of course it's much, much less energy demanding. It's much simpler, but still effective. So it's much less energy demanding than the previous models coming from basically from Silicon Valley. But overall, we will need more energy for the artificial intelligence. I'm very optimistic that that energy will mainly be sourced by solar and wind, simply for the reason I've given so many times in this podcast. These are not the cheapest sources of energy. Even in the United States, they developed quite a lot of new solar energy last year. And I doubt that Trump will be able to turn the clock back. That normally don't happen. I remember in the 1990s, when I came into the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Oslo, some people said, oh, some older people said, oh, there's something new here. It's called the internet. And that's for some young people can do that. It will not last. It will be a fashion and it will go away. And of course it didn't, nor did the first industrial revolution turn away. And not, Trump is not at all able to turn back the solar and wind revolution, because it's driven by the forces of the market, the price. But artificial intelligence is an enormous threat. It can be used for wars, for terrorism, for fake news, for a lot of negatives. But as many other technologies, it's also an enormous positive force for good. It can be used to make the energy systems a lot more effective, can make it make everything much more rational, which will reduce cost, can make us understand nature a lot better. And there are numerous other areas of use. Just to mention one example, we will get autonomous cars. Well, the number one cause of death in the world for young people, those between 15 and 20, is road accidents. Not malaria, not wars, not suicide, not any other disease, is road accidents. And well, the autonomous artificial intelligence powered car, well, it will never drink. It will never speed above the speed limit. It will never fall asleep. So nearly all the normal reasons for car accidents will be removed. It will take some time. It will not work perfectly from day one. But I'm sure that in, say, 15 years' time, nearly all cars in the city of Bologna will be autonomous, and the number of car accidents will come down. So let's embrace the positive opportunities of artificial intelligence, but also let's go for global regulations of the negatives, which are also there.
Okay, since you mentioned about global regulations and using solar energy or renewable energy to power AI, even though the theme of the summit was plug baby plug, in the statement it was not included anything about renewable energy or how much or from where these energy will come from. Do you think there is a problem here? Because every year when we think about AI summits, we leave out the part from where we should get the energy. And you said US will be on board of renewable energy theme, even though politically there are differences of opinion. US didn't sign the AI summit 2025, the final statement. So do you really think they are on board? And yeah, let's finish it off with this final question.
Yes, I think there is no way you can turn the clock backwards. I don't think Trump in any way can revive the coal industry. I mean, in the US, and he will even struggle to really bring forward the oil and gas industry, simply because what's destroying the coal and oil and gas industry in the world? It's not political decisions. To put it shortly, what's destroying it is Tongwei. Well, that's the largest solar company in the world. You can add Jinko, Trina, Longi, Jia. These are the all Chinese companies, but they are dominant forces in the solar industry. Just Tongwei alone, if it had been a separate country, not just a company, it would have been the sixth largest producer of renewable energy in the world last year. So this revolution is not coming from political decisions. Trump will not be able to turn it backwards, at least not in a massive scale. And it's the forces of business which are making this cheap and efficient and good for everyone.
That was great, very informative. Thank you, Eric, for sharing your time, insights and expertise with us. It has been an incredible opportunity for both me and our listeners to hear directly from someone with such vast experience in climate policy, diplomacy and sustainability. I think it is very hard to get all three in one person. We appreciate your dedication to creating a more sustainable world. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. Remember, every small action adds up to a greater impact. Stay informed, spread awareness, and be part of the change. We look forward to having you with us in our next episode. Until then, take care and keep pushing for a greener future. Goodbye.
You have been listening to Climate Challenge, a podcast by the International PhD College of the University of Bologna. You can find all episodes, all the references, and additional information on the college in the show description.